Hey, everybody. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 327. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. The festival, which is based in Bay City, Michigan, will take place in September between the 22nd and 25th of 2016. Hey, listen, if you're a filmmaker and you're listening to the podcast and you're thinking of different festivals to potentially submit your film to, consider Hell's Half Mile. I've been there. I know the people that program the festival. I'm very proud to have them as a sponsor and have been a juror. And I can guarantee you that, indeed, it is a great place to show your film with a very, very appreciative and engaged crowd, and you'll be treated like royalty when you get there. And it's a beautiful town in the heart of the Midwest. So consider submitting your film to Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. So by the way, while you're there, you'll get a great taste of local music, as well as seeing some great films and seeing some great panels and meeting a lot of new friends. You can go to hhmfest.com and find out more. If you're interested, you can submit your film either using Without a Box or a Film Freeway to submit your film to this particular festival. The early bird deadline goes on through January 15th. The regular deadline is through March 15th. And finally, the late deadline will be later in the spring on April 15th, 2016. Again, the festival takes place September 22nd through the 25th. I welcome Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival as a sponsor. Thank you very much for that. And now on with the show. This is episode number 327. Excuse me if my voice has a little bit of a rasp to it. I'm getting over a cold. Maybe I pushed it a little hard. There were a number of holiday parties, and I tried to pace myself, but perhaps I didn't do such a great job of that. This episode, I'm very proud of it. I'm finally able to post a couple of shows that I've been, or segments, I should say, that I've been sitting around on my computer, but I've been meaning to get on the show. It's just been difficult. Well, the first segment is with Kara Buckley, who is the carpetbagger for the New York Times. Her assignment is basically to follow the award show trajectory throughout the year, and they are in the thrust of it right now. And so I appreciate all the more that Kara agreed to come on to the podcast and indeed was a great, great guest. So, Kara, thank you very much. And it helps to have somebody on for the New York Times. So hopefully they'll be a little bit more on their radar, too. That would be nice. But she does a tremendous job there. She's now in her second year as the carpetbagger. You may recall that David Carr was the carpetbagger for a bunch of years, going back a little bit now, and had actually moved on well before his death. It's just that, that was an unfortunate situation, of course, and it really rocked the entire world of journalism and I think the culture in a broader way, frankly. So Kara Buckley's now been doing it for going into her second year, and really seems like she's got a great head on her shoulder. She's covered a lot of interesting different beats in the past, and I just had a great time talking with her. So Kara Buckley will be the first guest. After that, I welcome on my friend Simon Kilmurray, who I used to even report to for a short time when I was doing some freelance work at POV some years ago. He is now the executive director for the International Documentary Association out in Los Angeles. I met up with him at the Woodstock Film Festival this fall, where we sat down and had a relatively brief conversation about this move of his and his background. From Scotland, from the streets of Glasgow to the hills of Los Angeles, and it's been quite a journey. So thank you, Simon Kilmurray, for coming on the show, and I'm glad to finally post that. Up after that is a lovely friend of mine named Thelma Adams, who I've known for some time. Thelma has been writing about film whether in criticism or an interview format, for years now, working for a slew of top-level media outlets. And she continues that through this day. And she's working on a book now, which hopefully we'll come around to in a few months and maybe meet up with her again so she can update us on that and sell a few books. So what a great jam-packed penultimate episode of the podcast we have. Yes, I will have one more episode at the end of the year, before the end of the year, to say a fond farewell for 2015. As for this episode, it's just a great episode. I should mention, by the way, before we get into the episode, I did have the time last weekend to take my son to see Star Wars The Force Awakens, and it was everything and more. I really enjoyed it. We had a blast going, and it was great to see all those great old faces. Of course, I'm talking about C-3PO, R2-D2, and Chewbacca, as well as a few others. And as everyone is saying, all these the new actors in the film are blend terrifically with the old, all seamlessly. And the storyline is at once familiar and freshly new. It makes sense because it's only a few decades after this. The Empire, the Return of the Jedi story, right? So, it makes sense that since it picks up sometime after that there would be a continuity there. There's a lot of twists in the film, several, I should say, a number of unexpected things happen, great and sad, but it all works really well. And so my son and I, we had a blast going. So there was that. The other two films I got to catch so far is Creed, which also did a very nostalgic turn, but also, like Star Wars, The Force Awakens, I find Creed to be a contemporary feeling film as it is a nostalgic one. Rocky is almost a secondary character in this film. He is a secondary character in the film, but he has a substantial role. Yeah, it's a sensational film, and directed by Ryan Coogler, who did Fruitvale Station just a couple of years ago. And, I'm hoping one day to get Coogler on the show. I'd very much enjoy that. But I had a really good time watching that. And then finally, I saw Spotlight, which also, I mean, the talk is that will probably be maybe the front runner for Best Picture this year. Or should say next year's Oscars. Perhaps that's the case. All I know is I really, really enjoyed it. And if you catch it, one of the secondary characters is in this film is played by a friend of this podcast, Neil Huff, who is an actor who was on this show a few months ago when we talked about a film called Runoff. Neil was in that segment, and maybe we can get Neil back on soon, because he's a lovely guy and he does a great job in this film called Spotlight. So I urge you to go see all three of those films as soon as you can. And next up in my list is Chi-Raq, which I hope to see this coming weekend. So I'll keep you abreast of that. Now let's get into the show. First up here again is my conversation with the Carpetbagger over at the New York Times. You should follow her articles and you'll kind of get all the important information you need leading up to all the different award shows, which are just around the corner. Cara Buckley. I don't know. I'm a slow starter, truthfully. I've always been slow at the start. So the expectations are relatively low. But then you're surprised. So it's always good, because if you start and you sound really smart and then, you can't.
There's
barely
lower but down.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's my strategy, and it generally works for me. So.
How
Cara.
Yes.
Yeah. Buckley. Go ahead. You can ask anything.
How long?
Because you're a journalist, so you probably, it's your nature too.
How long are we?
Oh, we're going to talk? That's a good first question. 20 minutes.
Great.
Okay, something like that.
All right.
Or till things come to a awkward halt and
super.
Whatever happens first.
All right.
So thank you for coming out here. This is the first time I'm doing this. You're the first person I've done the podcast from here. But it's like
great space.
It is a good space.
Professional.
Isn't it? I know, and like the Today Show, we've got lots of people standing outside.
Clamoring.
Looking in. Truthfully, nobody is, but hypothetically, it could be the
They're
case.
They're glancing in every now and then.
Right. Like, who is that woman? Well, let me find out a little bit about you, and then we can talk about award season or whatever we want to talk about. So tell me a little bit, where'd you grow up?
Until I was 8, Ireland, and then the family moved to Canada.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I guess I did read something that you were from Canada.
Yeah, I am from the Great White North, formerly white. Well,
yeah.
No.
Well,
snow.
It's going to be 63. If it's 63 here on Christmas, which it's supposed to be, in Toronto, it's going to be 63 too. But I'm not saying you were from, maybe because you came from Ireland. I don't know. It still might make sense that you were in Ontario, but where did you grow up?
Outside Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah, northwest.
Okay, very good. Mm. Northwest of Toronto.
Arguably a no man's land that people might want to escape, but not everybody. You know,
yeah.
Some people liked it there.
Uh-huh. I've got a lot of friends who live there, in Toronto, you mm-hmm. know. But it's interesting how 99% of the Canadian population hovers just about 100 miles or so above the U.S. border there.
It's a constant state of, you know, denial and acceptance of the mighty power to the south.
Yeah, but it's got to be just developed and warmer and a number of other things, right?
All those things, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, the lakes and the sea, maybe there's enough, just barely enough warmth, you know, there. And then you get up into the hinterlands, and when you go cottaging or whatever you guys
right.
do.
Right, cottage country.
Yeah, exactly. See, I know. And then you moved to New York originally,
yeah.
or did you go, because you've been writing for other periodicals before the New York Times.
Right, I came mm-hmm. here to go to grad school at the Columbia's International Affairs School. Uh-huh. And then I got a job at the Miami Herald, kind of by accident. Uh-huh. I didn't mean to be in Florida, but it's what happened. I spoke some Spanish, and I was hired as an intern at the Reuters Bureau down there.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Well, again, Miami is, in a sense, like Austin is in Texas. Maybe Miami is a little bit no offense to those who live in Fort Lauderdale and whatever the hell towns you live in. But, I mean, Miami is sort of the most international
very much so
city and has
Absolutely.
The most to offer, I suppose, if you're a city kid.
And the people say, you know, one of the great things about Miami is how close it is to the United States. And it
yeah.
is so diverse, and Spanish is a first language. And
yeah.
it's a real, you know, it's a town run by Latinos, by and large. And very interesting. Always news. People are crazy in Florida. They do crazy things.
Yes.
They strive hard. Haitians, you know, sort of risking their lives to come across to land there. Then there's hurricanes. Quite frequently. So it's just, in terms of being a journalist, low-hanging fruit in Miami at all times.
Oh, yeah. Not to rush ahead, but I noticed when I was reading over your bio that there doesn't seem to be logical progression to being the carpetbagger. But then again, for David Carr and what was the...
Milena Rysik.
Milena mm-hmm. in between. I don't know that there was for them either. It seems a little bit... I don't know if arbitrary is the right word.
I think that's a fair word. I think, you know, the carpetbagger, the name isn't completely by accident. It's a play on the red carpet.
Sure.
And also play on someone being an outsider to this world. And I certainly was, you know, David was. David did it. You know, he's sui generis. I don't even know how, and I don't know how to say that word, but there was no one like David. You know, anything he pointed himself at, he would give a amazingly fresh viewpoint on. And certainly him versus the Oscars was quite a thing to behold.
I know, it was a surprise, you know, having followed him for a little while and then reading his book. And then he just slipped so easily into the role of carpetbagger. It's like all of a sudden he's just like talking to all the celebrities and what have you. And also you sort of seem to have to come up with some sort of rationale about offering a rationale about the Oscars or hedging the bets and talking about, I don't know if that's part of what you're doing there, but you know, it seems like you have to have a sense of what are the films, who are the you know, actors mm-hmm. and crew and to kind of keep an eye out for as the season, as the, you know, awards are being handed out and all.
For sure. And I think David, you know, one of the things he told me when I was taking it over was they're not your friends, they're your fake friends. But it's a very intoxicating world, as much as it's in a bubble. He loved movies and he always could sort of pick up the narratives of things that other people couldn't quite see.
Right. Being smart, I guess, is a
yeah.
key factor.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah.
Just being real
certainly.
Smart.
Well, maybe for him and Milena, I'm trying. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. You've been doing that for a little while, right?
This is my second my second year doing it.
Is there an expiration date on it, or is it just a matter of like, okay.
When I keel over? I mean, Milena did it for 5 years,
oh,
which
wow.
was Herculean. David yeah. did it for 4, and he said after 3 he was ready to, you know,
yeah.
pack it in. There isn't. I think having a fresh eye helps because it's just, it's very surreal, and there seems to always be more and more awards popping up
yes.
at all times. And for the talent being herded dog and pony style to the next event and the next event, saying the same thing over and over, we all know we're part of the circus. And how many new ways can you express that? I don't know. A lot of studio people I've spoken to are just dreading it, even though, I mean, the studio people often dread it because it's so much work. And then, but it's a cottage industry, not even a cottage. It's an industry, you know, the publicists, the restaurants that hire out these, their venues for, you know, meals, Q&As, whatnot. So
right.
the tail is now wagging the dog,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
that's not how it started
yeah.
out with
yeah.
awards, but now, hell yeah.
Yeah. I kind of feel that as you talk about it, at a certain point, the tail wagging the dog, it's sometimes it's that, and sometimes it's also how technology and other things change, and then all of a sudden you're still trying to sort of retrofit something. Like one of the things that I talk about on the show a lot is the fact that we're still trying to make every people are rolling their eyes already that listen, but that we're always trying to make every film work into a theatrical in a theater for 7 days.
Right.
And, of course, one of the things that was always one of the motivating factors was always that New York Times review, speaking of
right.
which. But even so, even without that, I mean, you know, the idea that you have to qualify for this award or that, you know, whatever. You have to have that theatrical in order to get, you
right.
know, a number of different things.
Right, exactly. A week run in L.A. and New
or
York.
New York.
Or New York.
Or New York. And then you get to be nominated potentially for something, or you get the reviews, or
right.
you get maybe international distributors want to make sure that you've got a legitimate film. So for the legitimacy of it, I understand that. But, you know, you have theaters sitting empty for 5 days.
For
it
sure.
makes
and
very
it,
little
it,
sense. So we're still, you know, it's
yeah.
it's like, well, surely there must be another way. You know?
I absolutely agree. And it's, you know, not dissimilar to other campaigns. It's money and politics. You know,
yeah.
a lot of where is the money? You can tell early in the season in terms of who's contacting me. I know if people are contacting me, oh, they're specific people. There's 3 or 4 who will contact me. And I think, oh, this studio clearly wants an awards run. Or, you know, other people who watch this sort of thing can tell just by the pedigree of the film, you mm-hmm. know, the director, the star, that they have their eyes on the prize for sure.
So you have like a beginning of your season?
Yeah. It starts for us. I mean,
yeah.
it starts for us with the Gotham Awards, which are
right.
the first week, usually in December. I hope I'm not mucking that up. But for other people who make this a year-round sport, if not blood sport, certainly it starts at Sundance and Cannes, mm-hmm. Venice, which I'm probably mucking up the times. And as early as I think the summer, you might start to get people putting together lists well in advance of when the movies come out, well in advance before when anyone has seen them. But for us, it's December 1st.
Okay. I guess, you know, we're right now in the definitely in the thrust of the best ofs and, you know, all the people starting to figure out which awards are going to be the you know, the nominations for this, for Oscars, et cetera. Are you saying it starts earlier? I mean, when, like, even the fall films
oh,
haven't come
sure.
out, which,
sure.
because they've been in the festivals. So, like, all the, those, you know, journalists and other people in the industry have seen a lot of the films that are going to be coming out in the fall, which will be the last
they have.
Group of films being.
But not always. I mean, there's a couple
right.
of things going on here. One of the things is, you know, a lot of these sites are, they're blog sites, and they need advertising, and they need material for the advertising, you know, journalism mm-hmm. being in a rough state in terms of, for all the obvious reasons, you need to have fresh material. So people are speculating well ahead of having seen a film. You know, one of the, and this is, Telluride is in early September and then the Toronto International Film Festival, but people will start prognosticating before then, partly because they need material, largely because they would need they need material, and there's no fault in that. I mean, we know, you know, like I said, what's happening with journalism. But I think of last year, everyone was forecasting Angelina Jolie's Unbroken would just come out on top. I mean, until they saw it, you know, and it was a tough film, but
yeah.
it was on the top of a lot of people's lists because just there were all of these factors that played into it that made people think she's got a prize on her hands.
It was her time being one of the that kind of.
I guess. And, you know, she had introduced the person upon whose life the film was based at the governor's ball the year before. And a lot of people saw this as early courtship of the Academy voters and just thought by the pedigree of the film, it was based on a bestseller by the woman who wrote Seabiscuit, mm-hmm. had Angelina Jolie. It had, you know, all of these factors. But then it did fantastically at the box office. But it just... Yeah. kind of fell right off of everyone's list.
Interesting.
For the most part.
Yeah. Is it all just to prove that there's really no way to predict anything at the end? It's like people, you know, it's a fickle type of industry.
I'm still getting my head around, you know, how to forecast which way the wind is blowing or how to even see it when it is blowing. You've got 6,000 Academy members and to sort of say, what is the Academy thinking? I mean, I don't know. What is 6,000 group of anybody who are highly subjective thinking? And, you know, we do know how the Academy skews demographically, older, white, male. Mm. And so there are some films that seem to play right into that perfectly. And you think, they're going to love this. But there's no guarantee. And last year, I think a lot of people were really toggling. The narrative last year was Boyhood or Birdman. Mm-hmm. And with people just really trying to guess what the Academy would think. And I don't know if we got it right, you know, in the end. A lot of people really thought Boyhood. And does it matter? Someone is always going to win. But we have to have this conversation to keep the material flowing.
Right, of course.
It's bizarre in a way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that it certainly sends a message to the world in a way. I mean, when 12 Years a Slave won, you know, some Academy members admitted that they voted for it without even seeing it because it was too rough. But they wanted to send a message, you know, look, we acknowledge the sins of this country's past, say. And there's real heft, too, behind which documentary films get nominated. Something like The Cove, which was about the slaughter of dolphins in Taiji, Japan, after that got nominated and then it went on to win. The numbers of dolphins getting slaughtered at this particular place every year dropped by 14,000 a year. So it can have real repercussions, too. So it's, you know, I think on one hand, it's sort of easy to make fun of this race and sort of, you know, wonder, God, are we paying way too much attention? But there's also some real life, you know, consequences or repercussions.
Sure, sure. And, you know, in the narrative category, too, I mean, you know, I mean, the films, it seems like there's a more, I don't know, it seems like there's more and more thoughtfulness and artistic thoughtfulness around the types of films that are coming through, you know, like Birdman, like 5 years ago. I don't know if Selma, I mean, you know, these are kind of more, and the films that are being held up, Boyhood, I mean, you know, these are kind of like these indie spirited films or independent films in some cases that are a few years back were not just in contention, you know. They really were. So there seems to be a shift. So even if it's primarily, you know, older white males, perhaps they're just a younger or a next generation of older white males that seem to be a little bit more, I don't know, open-minded or I'm not sure.
I'm not either because 5 years ago I wasn't really. I was way out of the loop. I was doing, you know, a completely different job. So.
Right. Were you at the Times?
I was at the Times. I joined there actually 2006, so it's been a while. Perhaps. I started off as a police reporter. I spent a couple months at the Baghdad Bureau. Then I came back. I covered public housing, and then I wrote about 20-somethings. And then I did it all over the map, but always in the metro section or in the news section, you know.
Sandy.
Oh, yes, Hurricane Sandy. I covered Hurricane Sandy. Yeah. I almost got washed away in my rented truck in Red Hook, complete hubris because I'd covered so many hurricanes in Florida. I said, I got this. Don't worry. I'll be fine to the editors. And they said, you know, we'd love you in Red Hook when it hits. I said, no problem. And one of the things when you're covering a hurricane, you have to get up high. You got to get a rental vehicle up high off the grounds. But then the problem is if you rent a flatbed truck, the wind can – anyway – long and short of it, I was in Red Hook and the surge hit of water. And it took me a while to realize what was happening. I saw these emergency vehicles rushing away from the shoreline to get out of Red Hook. And my mind didn't really understand what it was seeing. And then
I'm a reporter holding up a badge. I'm a reporter. I'm pressed.
They rushed right by my car to get the hell out. And then next thing you know, this giant rush of water came, and then my truck was floating.
Oh my God.
And there were power lines exploding into the water. It was one of my scarier moments, and I've covered, you know, far fiercer hurricanes, but anyway.
Is there anything, I'm sorry to ask, are you a parent? Or
no, I'm not.
Okay, okay. I only ask because, you know, those are the kinds of things that kind of go through your mind.
Right.
Like, why would I put myself in this kind of...
Even not being a parent.
No, you're right.
I thought, you know, but I just thought...
And somebody's your parent, by the way. They would be probably pissed off.
But anyway, yeah, so I was doing sort of, you know, different kind of coverage before, mm-hmm. before the
right.
carpet bag.
Yeah, I'll say. Far less dangerous, but maybe, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. The last thing I saw you writing about was joy, and, you know, seemed like you were sitting in a hotel room with Jennifer Lawrence, Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro.
Right, and David O. Russell.
And David, of course, David O. Russell.
Yeah, I know.
Does that not feel as surreal on some level as being your truck floating away or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly different. I will say, you know, I'd covered news for a while, and I did get to a point where there's a cyclical nature to news. Bad things keep happening to people and with regularity, which is what a lot of news is about. And I was wondering, you know, will I stay in news forever when the carpetbagger opportunity came along? This is sort of, to me, a new avenue of thought. It's mm-hmm. a little bit more intimate. You're mm-hmm. talking with people who talk about themselves all the time. You're trying to get a new angle or some mm-hmm. kind of, you know.
Yeah.
And so it is different. It's a different animal completely. I will say that having covered news for so long, it's a great preparation because I don't take it, not that you shouldn't take it seriously, but it's not like covering, I don't know, the Supreme Court, you know.
Yeah, sure.
So,
is there ever any embarrassment around it? I mean,
last year I would really back into it, talking to these people. Oh, you know, I didn't used to do this. But who cares? I mean,
you're an apologist.
Kira Knightley does not care what I used to do, you
right.
know? So yeah. Now I just sort of think I'm doing this now.
Yeah.
There is sort of a bit of abashedness, though, even though I think it's completely legitimate. And I think, you know, people really mm-hmm. read this stuff, and we need readers.
Yeah.
And it's also a reflection of our culture in a way. And, you know, you can get at interesting insights from people, like people who are shrewd observers of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though they're celebrities, they often have interesting things to say. I mean, I've interviewed Helen Mirren, and she was fantastic. And, you know, a regal yet grounded woman
yeah.
who is an inspiration to us all. And I think that people look to, despite human nature of humans creating a royalty system with Hollywood, when you get those sort of things you can look up to and that are interesting and, mm-hmm. you know, why not explore it a bit?
Is it internally in the Times? Is there also that kind of, I don't know if there's still the sort of senatorial kind of elder.
Do you mean?
Well, you know what I'm saying, like guys that are still part of the old guard. And again, those would probably be mostly.
I wish there were more because, you know, we've yeah. had rounds of layoffs and we just tend to, the most seasoned, wonderful people are also the ones that sort of end up leaving in those times.
Yeah. Maybe they're also at the point where they're just like through. Obviously, my time has passed on the sense of, you know, the way I approach.
Yeah. I there's certainly still some there. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's just different. I'm in the culture desk now, and it's a different animal from being in the metro section. My editor is a woman. The uh-huh. deputy editors are women. Culture feels a bit more reflective instead of reflexive.
Mm-hmm.
And metro, you run and gun a lot. Uh-huh. You know, you
oh,
need
yeah.
to cover the city, and it is, so it just feels like a different metabolism in culture.
Sure, almost and, like it's in other words, almost sometimes like it's a different periodical. In the sense,
It is. You know, the Times does try and be all things to all people, and it certainly right. annoys a lot of people. That's fine if they just, you know, keep on reading it. But yeah, I would say each section has its own flavor. You know, and certainly mm-hmm. culture is different from Metro.
Well, I will say that in the last few years, they really have gotten a and this is just one, you know, schmuck's opinion, but they've really kind of managed to really create a digital space that's its own fresh, unique kind of
approach.
It's not like here's the digital version of the paper.
Right.
It's no longer thinking of that. I mean, that would be kind of, I'm sure that's an old, already that's even a conversation that sort of hasn't been going on recently because, but I've really been able to appreciate that because I just have picked up the physical New York Times in ages. But my father still reads it every day, like every morning.
And you always come across, I still get the weekend paper and, you know, it sits there and I sort of feel guilty about it. But when flip through it, you know, it's like anything, real life is much realer, and flipping through that page, you know, there you happen upon stories you wouldn't have read, and a screen glares at you. And it's just more relaxing to read the paper, but no one does it, or increasingly fewer people do it.
Yeah. But, you know, it's this conversation also around the tactile. It's been going on for at least a decade now.
Sure.
And people are still buying books. And I know it's a whole – the publishing world and bookstores are almost entirely gone. But, you know, regardless of how people get them, everybody still wants – read. I mean, there's very few people that are like, I think the Kindle or whatever it is.
Any way we can get them, for sure.
But the technology really has come to the point where, okay, maybe it makes sense to read your, you know, New York Times on this device or that, because it's really a great experience, and they are really,
really invested,
really designed it really well. So, you know, yeah, they've obviously made it in. They've had to, of course.
Right.
One film, though, I do want to talk about as we wind down. I want to respect your time, and that is we got to talk about Spotlight because, well, I haven't seen it, so I feel like I can talk about it. But I'm seeing it this weekend.
Oh, cool!
I'm going because I've had like so many opportunities to see it and just not able to make them, you know, as many invitations as I've gotten over the time, it's number of festivals or wherever. But, you know, I'm very excited to see it because on one hand, it celebrates real journalism. You know, these are journalists practicing journalism, having meetings.
It can be tedious.
There is, I don't know. I wasn't even thinking. Are there moments that are tedious in the film?
But it just depicts a lot of
tedium.
the grunt work that is journalism.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of the depictions you see is, you know, these mobs of reporters screaming at the gates of whatever when someone's coming out the courtroom steps, they're yelling at them. And I've been in those situations, and I've very rarely seen that mob or that depiction. And it's often a very quiet profession. You're trying to get people to talk who might not want to. You're in your head trying to come up with fresh ways to tell a story or which parts of the story to tell that elucidate the rest of the story.
Right.
And I think that, especially newsrooms these days, they're also quite quiet. We don't have clattering typewriters. I just love the depiction of that, the regularity of the job of it. It's a job. It's not – if people come to the Times, they often sort of ask, is it always this quiet? And the answer is, well, yeah. You know, because we're writing.
And a lot of people now are writing from home too.
And they're writing from home.
Right. And it sort of celebrates – but it's interesting, right? This kind of validates something to people, like how this is our legacy. This is our –
100%.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the fallouts of plummeting ad revenue for newspapers has been they've downsized. And one of the things that Spotlight really spotlights is the necessity of investigative journalism to – the resources you need to sort of shine a light into something – you know, that in this case had been going on for decades, you know, and you need an independent fourth estate, but you need that in order to unearth these things, you know, an independent body that's not beholden. And absolutely when it comes to the abuses of the Catholic Church, you know, especially in Boston, as you find out in the movie throughout the country and beyond.
I should just say I grew up going to summer camp with Tony Scott. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh,
I think you might have emailed that to me.
Oh, maybe I did.
Yeah, you did.
Did I?
Yeah, I think you might have mentioned that.
Maybe early on. I forgot. It's been so long.
He sits near me.
Oh, does he?
So you get to call him Tony because you know him, because that's the sort of...
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
That definitely we have a lot of... we met in the... I don't know. I don't even remember what year. Maybe 80 or something. I don't know. This was fun because finally sit down with you because... I enjoy the long, slow chase. I don't suggest that you were running away, but it took a while to get this together.
Right.
And to me, and also because I'll let months go by and then come back, you know, that's sometimes it just happens. But
the first season, too, was so crazy for me. They've thankfully reduced my workload so I can not be insane. You know, it was, this was a pace that David kept up, Milena kept up, and they've dialed it back, you know, that it's just I can breathe a bit this year. And so I have a little bit more time on my hands. So,
well, thank you for.
Thank you for inviting
for including
me.
This. Okay, thank you. And I've known Simon Kilmurry for some time. I don't remember the circumstances we met, but I'm proud to have had POV and the folks over there as friends for some time. We even did a bunch of screenings together where I co-hosted some screenings with them over at the Brooklyn Museum a few years ago. I've hosted several screenings on my own when I was doing a regular series. Whenever I would have on a POV filmmaker or show, rather, a POV doc, they were very, very involved in that. That's what they do over there at POV. But now Simon Kilmurry he's the executive director over at the International Documentary Association. We're going to find out a lot about what they do champion documentaries around the world. So, again, we met up at Woodstock Film Festival a couple months ago where he was a juror at that festival, and I was visiting, and this is the conversation we had there.
So how long have you been doing this now?
Since sometime in 2011.
That's great. But it's great that you kept it up so long.
I don't even have a rationale for it.
Do you
I
have
don't understand why
a sense of who how big your audience is or who they are?
Yeah, it's, let's see, you got mom, dad. I don't even have them, to be honest with you. I know that the people that listen are really into it. And I think it has I don't want to oversell it or misrepresent it, but I think it has its own little impact. I think, and I think people really that like it really listen to it and are real loyal listeners, is my guess. Because I get a lot of emails, I get a ton of, I'm sure nothing compared to your POV or IDA types of. on that level. But it's nice. Almost every day or every few days, there's an email in about, help for, help or just to maybe just introduce themselves and their project they're working on. And I'm very honored by that, I really find it, I never take it for granted, So I get back to everybody, not always right away, but. So for me, just to know people are listening is a blast, Honestly, though, I do need to really, first of all, welcome, Simon, finally. I'm glad.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. It's actually, I know we were talking about, and I approached you about maybe coming on, and I didn't follow through, it's my bad, as the kids say, about that you haven't been on yet. But I'm in a way, I'm very glad, because I don't know that until more recently I would have done as good a job talking to you.
Uh-huh.
So I think I've gotten better lately.
Yeah, and... in some ways, it's also interesting now that I'm no longer at POV, because I have a somewhat freer...
What? What were you saying?
Freer way to kind of frame that work, and because I'm no longer representing the institution.
Right, right. Yeah. You were there 16 years?
Yeah.
It's really a remarkable run.
Yeah, yeah.
Executive director.
Executive director and executive producer since 2009. No, 2006.
Before that, you made the coffee there, right?
Before that, I was the COO. I had bunch of roles there, but always with the hope that I somehow would get more and more involved in the editorial of the series, and was lucky enough to do that.
Right, and so, and then you just started this past spring or summer?
Yeah, in July.
In July.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you already move to the West Coast, or is that something?
Yeah,
that
I moved to Los Angeles in June.
How's that going?
Great.
Yeah,
so
you
far.
Like it?
Yeah, it's. I've been going out to LA for years.
Right.
I knew the city reasonably well, although I realized I didn't know it at all. It's much more beautiful than I realized it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's quieter than Brooklyn. It's a huge and drastic change, but actually one which so far I'm really quite enjoying.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you were in New York for?
I moved to New York in '87, so 28 years.
That 28?
Yeah.
Is that 28 years ago?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't. I can't remember. That.
You were still in kindergarten, right?
Just a sparkle in my mother's eye. If people can hear you that don't know who you are or don't know you personally, that you're from Scotland.
Right.
Were you raised in Edinburgh? Or
Glasgow.
Glasgow.
Yeah.
Glasgow. So, but you went to school in Edinburgh?
I went to Edinburgh University. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then was it not long after that then? You must have moved to
the
States.
Yeah. I actually never finished university and came over to New York to explore life.
Yeah? As a young vagabond.
As a young vagabond in a very different city than it is now.
I'll say, right?
Yeah.
It's changed quite drastically. And what was your... if you even had a plan, what was the idea? Did you think, I'm going to get into media and broadcasting, and second, I'm staying in the States?
I didn't have any concrete plan, just to kind of see what would happen. I actually started working fairly early on with a filmmaker, photographer, and...
Who's that?
A guy called Neil Slavin does a lot of editorial work for places like... New York Times and magazines and a lot of catalog work. And he also made some short films, actually short docs, which I helped produce. But I initially wanted to get involved in the music business in some fashion, not knowing quite what that would look like. I remember starting to go to places like Film Forum and Thalia and watching stuff. I remember going to Brothers Keeper, Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky's film when it was released at Film Forum, and being kind of blown away by it.
Yeah.
And I was also, I moved in '87, and actually POV started on broadcast in '88. And I was just, I'd watch it on occasion, thought this stuff's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Doug Block earlier today, and I remember seeing Silver Lake Life on broadcast, which was like another one of those moments. I think, you have those moments which are kind of eureka moments. They kind of transform how you look at films, and that was one of those moments for me also.
Really?
Of like, oh my God, it was kind of the height of the AIDS crisis. There was a lot of hyperbole. There was a lot of fear in the air.
Yeah.
And this was a love story, and personal diaries and using all this kind of intimate video and heartbreaking and beautiful. And it was one of those, having grown up on kind of classical BBC documentaries, which are heavily narrated and historical in nature and
Voice of God.
Yeah.
Narration.
Yeah. Which I liked. I love Panorama and, those shows on BBC. And, I remember watching The World at War, this kind of multi-part seminal documentaries, World War II series. I think it was on Granada or somewhere. I thought it was fascinating. But seeing films like Silver Lake Life and Brothers Keeper were like, okay, this is a whole different kind of filmmaking.
And this was during a time where, even though like Brothers Keeper was something of a hit, I suppose, relative term for a documentary, but there was no, there was no category in a sense. It wasn't a category yet, right? It was a few years later,
where it
sort of become a thing, right?
Maybe there was a category amongst the filmmaking community, but those outside of it was something.
The ghetto of documentary filmmaking, basically.
Which I think it probably was a little bit of a ghetto back then, or definitely a more marginal part of the culture.
Mm-hmm. But you were there then for the entire, that entire explosion.
Well, I wasn't at POV then. I didn't start at POV until 99, but
It
I was beginning
like
to
So before POV,
observant.
Though, go ahead.
I was working with another arts organization, but not
okay.
in film.
Okay. Oh, I see.
A literary arts organization in New York.
Oh, okay.
So I'd always been a nonprofit, and I was doing fundraising and mm-hmm. nonprofit management stuff, and that's what I started at POV to do.
I see. Right. So. I got you. Okay. So it was 99.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I could do the math. 16 years is and change, right?
Yeah.
Right now. And so when you started at POV, was it, I mean, were you were, first of all, I guess the offices were at the time in Manhattan.
We were in Chelsea. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And was it, it was obviously, I mean, when I was there, it was still a pretty small office, but
yeah.
was it? You didn't have a digital component, and there was, I mean, it was
there was when I started, there was early,
still relatively early days of the internet.
Yeah, it was very early days of the internet. But Mark Weiss, who was the
right.
who founded POV, was really actually pretty innovative with that. Even before I started, there was mm-hmm. programs, a film about Vietnam veterans, and and he created this online story sharing, early Netscape,
Right, Netscape, right.
Exactly,
And if you had a CompuServe account,
yeah,
you had a
yeah, but for years it was one of the most popular things on POV's website, even though it was very, very early days of the internet.
Right.
And so it was pretty innovative in terms of embracing that digital space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of it was, enhanced content to support films
right.
or allow viewers to engage with the stories more.
Right. Yeah.
But it was really pretty innovative.
Well, that's probably true for the internet in general. It
yeah.
was like nobody looked at it as a content platform
right.
in of
right.
itself,
yeah.
know, at the, for many years. And there was no Facebook. And
no,
know how we all
no there
along.
Was no MySpace.
<That's> even. Friendster. I don't know if you remember that.
Such a good name.
So Mark was there. So the two of you, did you have a period of
We didn't
really together?
Cross over.
No. He was gone by
Mark,
the time.
Mark was gone. He was off running WebLab, although we
right.
certainly interacted.
Yeah.
Ellen, when I joined POV, Ellen Schneider was executive director and Lisa Heller was executive producer.
Okay.
Lisa went to HBO.
Uh-huh. Right.
And Kara Murtis came in.
I'm sorry?
And then Kara Murtis came in.
Oh, okay, Kara Murtis.
Yeah, for 5 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
6 years.
And then she left and you took over for the executive director
yeah.
role? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And was there a, did you feel like you needed to create a new vision or a new, I don't know, like a mission for
I mean, I think
POV?
One of the interesting things about a series like POV, I mean, it evolved from a series that was purely acquisition of finished films into one that became more involved in funding and production of films.
Mm-hmm.
The digital side expanded a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The community engagement and outreach side expanded a lot.
Right.
Education work. So all of those things were expanding when Kara was there. And I think I maybe had a somewhat different curatorial approach,
mm-hmm.
although we still use the same method of bringing in an editorial advisory committee,
mm-hmm.
which is a process which I really liked
mm-hmm.
to seek input from people. Mine might have been a little less heavy on the social issue films, although there's certainly a fair share of those
mm-hmm.
films, maybe a little more international.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what, when you have a series like POV and you have different people coming in, they're each going to shape it a little bit differently.
Sure.
I think just building on what other people have done before them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. And one of the things I noticed, which I don't know occurred with your predecessors, but one thing I noticed and still notice is the championing of filmmakers and your relationship with filmmakers is really it's a big thing.
Right.
With you. Your relationships with a lot of emerging young filmmakers,
yeah.
especially.
Yeah, yeah.
You've helped
yeah.
along quite a few.
Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as a... you can spot talent, I guess is what I'm saying.
I'm not sure about that. Because the filmmakers are the ones who do the really hard work. And when you see their
sure.
work, it's pretty obvious that they... It doesn't take a whole lot of work to spot that there's real talent there.
Yeah.
I think what I think is really important about the series for me was keeping space for new voices.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing back filmmakers who we've worked with previously is very important, but I think it's really important to keep space for new voices coming through both for the series, but also for the public media more broadly. And it's great, you know, when you can present someone's first film and help them get out to a national audience. That's fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really satisfying to be able to help someone like that. But they're the ones who do the hard work.
I know. Yeah. You're now an executive director at the International Association of Documentaries?
International Documentary Association.
Documentary Association.
I have a lot of, you know, it's an organization that's been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. It has a very prestigious awards every fall, and it has a magazine, which is a good publication. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of educational programs, mostly focused in the Los Angeles area, seminars and workshops. We have a filmmaker services program, which is fiscal sponsorship and then additional services that we provide for filmmakers and the big conference that we do every 2 years. But what my goal is really to expand the organization on a national level so that we're doing activities not just in Los Angeles but around the country and partnering with international organizations. I want to be doing more funding of films. So I have lots of plans. But the big challenge is going to be raising the money to do it all.
So do you have to be partly like, you have to be good at development, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right?
And I guess it's something I've done for a long, long time.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, working in public television.
Yeah. So I mean, with POV, we had to raise half the budget every year. PBS only covered about half of it, so.
Right. And no doubt that's part of the reason why they probably asked you to take the role.
Yeah. And I think I've got a pretty strong network. Of filmmakers and
there's that too.
Well, I mean, and now
I guess as you said, the IDA has been around a long time, and we were talking earlier about how, you know, documentaries were kind of a small genre of film relatively compared to today, where, you know, like I was watching this Mayor Vishnu documentary, but he's been in several documentaries as a supporting character, quote unquote,
right.
And now he's got his own vehicle.
Right.
And so it's sort of like that, where now it seems like anybody of note eventually will get a documentary. And then for also because of how quickly we can turn around a documentary, potentially. I mean, it really doesn't. Right. It's not. It could take years and years, of course.
Yeah, a lot of them take years.
Years and years. But it seems like there, for anybody who's interested in just about anything, there's probably at least one documentary.
I think they're more visible. They're less on the cultural margins. More kind of they're higher on, you know, people's choice of what they, you know, can do with their time. If you look at the New York Times any Friday, there's now 4 or 5
easily
docs being reviewed, and almost every week, and I think 15, 16 years ago, maybe it'd be one every few weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. But there isn't that enough places to see them.
No.
Is the big problem. No. And I don't know if that's part of the IDA's end goals, maybe to help that along. It doesn't have to be something that they're responsible for, of course, but because even on television, there's more than there has been, I suppose, with HBO docs and A&E. Right, yeah. They're still doing docs,
not doing too much on broadcast. I mean, they're certainly,
they
supporting some theatrical docs, which with Molly Thompson does great work.
Right.
But, there are, you know, on digital platforms, it's much easier to get the work out there than it was previously, which is great.
The iTunes,
but it's still. It's hard to get the visibility for them because there's so much more content.
As you say, there's a lot more competition for people's attention and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're still in a honeymoon period, obviously, having been there only about 3 months.
Yeah.
So there's not much to talk about for IDA yet. But
not yet. No, I'm hoping within... I want to be able to look back in a couple of years and see an organization that's really beginning to transform.
Yeah.
It'll take time because you've really got to raise the resources to that. So.
And what about producing? Have you... dabbled into producing your own films?
No. I mean, certainly I've executive produced, and I've been in the edit room with many filmmakers over the years and given my thoughts and help and help raise money for films, but maybe at some point.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you're on the jury here at Woodstock?
Yeah.
How'd that go?
Great. I was with on the jury with Alan Berliner and... whose films I've always been a fan of. And
he's a great filmmaker.
Sarah Bernstein from HBO, who's fantastic. In fact, I think it's the second time Sarah and I have been on the jury together this year. So.
Oh, who's that?
Sarah Bernstein,
of course.
From HBO.
Yeah. Is she around?
I haven't seen her yet, but she is coming up. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But she is supposed to, right. I'm sure, yeah, for the awards? Or?
I believe so.
Okay. And then back to L.A.? Or?
One day back in New York and then back to L.A.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, though.
Thank you.
And I really wish you all the luck in the world at IDA, but I don't think you're going to need it. I think it's going to be – they made a great choice there.
Well, fingers crossed.
What's the next festival?
I'm on the jury at New Orleans.
Okay. And that's a festival I'd
like
to go to.
And the Austin Film Festival, too. So I've got two –
coming up.
I can't remember which one comes first. One of them comes first.
So. That's in the fall, too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. So thanks again. And I'm glad we ran into each other.
Yeah,
thanks
likewise.
For sitting down for a few
Thank
minutes.
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it.
Also, while I was at Woodstock, I met up with Thelma Adams, who a lot of people may know if they read a lot of different film periodicals and are, you know, likes to keep up with all the different fresh voices out there. Thelma has certainly been doing it for some time and continues to be one of those voices. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Thelma Adams.
My worst interviewing experience, and everybody has them, and I would say that I am not tech savvy, but I have my little recorder, and of course I'm interviewing him for the movie that he directed and starred as Charles Dickens, which is a wonderful overlooked movie. Anyway, I sit down at the table to talk to him, and I guess sometime during, in the first minutes, the recorder died. So I get the greatest interview. He's really smart. He's really funny. He's really on topic.
Right.
And I realize not only am I not getting it, but I stand up and we say goodbye and I'm rushing off to get a plane to go to Los Angeles. And he says, "Sweetheart." I turned around and I said, "Yes." He said, "Your dress is tucked into the back of your tights."
Oh, my God. You know, the beauty part is no one will ever have to hear this story. Oh, wait a minute.
No, I think telling stories on oneself is fine.
Yeah.
I really, you know, at this point you've interviewed, I could tell you stories about the people that weren't nice, but that seems mean-spirited. I mean, yeah. Lord knows. The thing that people don't realize is that an interview is of the moment. So we're sitting here in Woodstock. It's the festival. It's rainy, sprinkly outside.
It is, right.
There's all those remnants. It's like a Woodstock theme park. You know, the guys with the funny hats and the tie-dye and all of this kind of
it's
stuff.
It's a uniform.
It's a uniform. It's a unicorn. So the thing is... it puts you in an odd frame of mind, in a way, because you're not in New York, you're not in L.A.
Right.
You're in this strange Disneyland of rock and roll.
Right. And but you live relatively close by.
I live relatively close.
What town again?
I live in Hyde Park. Home.
I tangled you up here.
Home. Ooh,
sorry.
I'm tangled up in you. We're going to do our Bob Dylan references.
That's right.
Now. Since we're in Woodstock, I live in Hyde Park, home of FDR, which is across the Hudson River, 45 minutes. So this is really my hometown. When I moved up from Brooklyn, this became my hometown film festival, and I started coming here, I'm 12 or 13 years ago.
So it was in its infancy still. Yeah,
you know what?
It's 16 years.
Yeah, it's 16 years old. I guess it was in its fourth or fifth year, something like that. My math is a little off.
That's called fuzzy math.
I had my fuzzy math as opposed to my Chicago math. And at that time, you know, that's when Melissa Leo was the fantastic actress. She has a place around here.
Right.
And she was very, and still is very active in the festival or very involved. And no one knew who she was. And that was before Frozen River. That was before The Fighter. And it was just like... Vera Farmiga was here 1 year with Deborah Granik's movie that has Bone in it. No, Winter, that... what was the one before Winter's Bone? But that movie won the Narrative Jury Award.
Was the one where she's an addict?
She's an addict.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that was a thing again where no one knew Vera Farmiga.
Right.
Now she has a big TV show.
Right.
She's in The Conjuring 2. There's a lot of people who, since its infancy, you know, a lot happens in 10 years.
A lot. And she was in The Departed, which is a big role.
So here are these two fantastic actresses. Mm-hmm. And who knew Vera Farmiga before? Up in the Air, I think, was one of her big crossover roles.
Yes, right. And her sister is an emerging actress, too.
Right. Right.
She's very talented. She looks almost like a...
Identical. They played mother-daughter in At Middleton.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting casting. Well, it's so easy just to... When I'm with somebody who's such an encyclopedia or has an encyclopedic knowledge of film, too... You can just sort of start talking, and the conversation goes where it goes, which is really lovely. So before, when you asked me, what are we talking about? We're talking about movies. But also, I do want to let people know who I'm talking with a little bit, because even though I'll do so in my intro. But Thelma Adams has been writing reviews and writing about film, and I think mostly from the creative side of it, in terms of what you're writing about. You're not writing about industry.
I began as a critic at the New York Post. Mm-hmm. I had been writing for years for those weekly giveaways, the West Sider and the Chelsea Clinton News. I started in, how do you become a film critic? You just write.
Right.
So I wrote for those, had a million clips, went to the New York Post, was there 6 years, Us Weekly 11.
I know.
And then I crossed over to online for Yahoo Movies. And I've always done interviews and features and opinion pieces. And for a good period, I wrote a lot about, since I was a mother, mommy, kind of mommy cinema.
Oh, yeah?
And
then the New York Observer, was that also
now,
one of your...
The most recent thing that you can read is I did a profile of Richard Gere.
Right.
For Time Out of Mind that came out this week
on the
cover of The Observer. Jesse Eisenberg, Julianne Moore, Patty Clarkson. I like talking to people and making them sound as smart as they really are.
Uh-huh.
That is all. My goal is to get people to really, to get a sense of who they are. And it's interesting because Jesse Eisenberg said to me that's one of the hardest parts for him as an interviewer, that everybody wants the real Jesse. But then you show the real Jesse and you say the wrong thing and it's suddenly... Comic-Con is like genocide all over, every Twitter feed. So it's a challenge.
Yeah. Also, I imagine that the publicists have to have not always have the same agenda as the subject their client.
Yes.
In terms of the real so-and-so. Like, no, this is the way we need to...
Position him.
Position, exactly. So that's always a challenge. I have my own challenge in that regard. Also, even though I'm doing something a little different, it's usually access and things like that. But I ran into you at the Time Out of Mind press.
Right, that was a good... Yeah, and I had met Oren Moverman because he's a great guy. He's the director.
Right.
He did a film that was at Toronto. He did The Messenger.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a movie called Rampart
about
with Woody
Harrelson.
And Anne Heche. And it was a really good L.A. noir, but also about a dirty cop who has this very strange, interesting relationship with two sisters, one of whom he happens to be married to. And
it's a great film.
It's a great film
really
just didn't catch fire. So I became a big, sometimes I part of my job is to be a big cheerleader of things that I believe in. And so I was a big cheerleader for Melissa Leo. I am a big cheerleader. Again, we were talking for women in film. I'm not saying we want more soap operas. I'm not saying, I want to see 50 Shades of Grey, like any women's movie. But I just feel like one of the things that I constantly harp on, and it sounds like harping, is that women are 51%. We want to see movies that reflect our life. We want to see it. People of color want to see it. We want to see movies like the movies in the 70s that were rich and interesting and challenging, even though, then again, most of the movies in the 70s were made by those same white males.
But they were sensitive. Not always.
Not always.
But they were sort of... But they were trying to do something...
I think Jaws was not as sensitive to the needs of the shark as it should have been.
It was not pro-shark.
It was not pro-shark. No. Sharks have a hunger. They need to continue. Anyway, you
get the idea. It actually did. It's funny you say that because it actually it was not accurate. Most sharks don't go after people. So it, in a way, it sort of it made things. They needed a good PR person for a long time to get their reputation back in line.
Exactly. Don't go in the water. A lot of people for a long time were afraid.
Yeah. Well, and also you're a novelist. Right, you wrote
a
novel.
Didn't
you write a novel?
I wrote a novel, which I'm comic novel dying to called read. Playdate that St. Martin's Thomas Dunn Books published a few years ago, and now I have a book that's coming out from Amazon Publishing next summer that's biographical fiction in the same way that The Paris Wife is biographical fiction or Loving Frank. This a historical story that people know about, but from the women's point of view. So this is a Western.
I understand. Oh, okay. Very good. So you're saying, in other words, there was a treatment or a novel that was written. It's become a classic, and we learned the narrator was a man. Is that what you're saying? Originally. And now there's this is an alternate narrative of the same story.
Right. Well, that would be like Wide Sargasso Sea would be that case. This is more history.
Okay.
And just taking – there's so many fascinating characters in history. And I'm Jewish American, and so I look for the Jewish American stories that don't fit the Stryber narrative.
So who's the person that you're writing about, or wrote about, or?
it's okay. It's great.
I know. I don't even mind.
I like that.
Yeah.
That we'll put in that excitement. It was excitement for my book.
It's okay, honey.
He's great. This is the story of Josephine Sarah Marcus, who became Josephine Sarah Marcus Earp. She went to Tombstone in her late teens and met and married Wyatt Earp, ultimately. And it's about how she ran away from home, why she was in Tombstone, what was the Tombstone that she saw. And we've all seen the movie Tombstone, and the woman who plays her is Dana Delaney, a 5-foot-something tall, willowy Irish-American, which is she was a Jewish-American. Literally, what is her background? What are these people? There are so many great, for me, there are so many great stories that have yet to be told, which is one of the reasons I get frustrated with Hollywood, because they keep remaking stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did we need another Man from U.N.C.L.E.? Did we need,
Yeah, right, right. And there was a girl from U.N.C.L.E., by the way.
There was.
Wasn't there? I think there was, this girl from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah,
I think there was a sequel.
But I just
I don't know
like
how quickly
so
they're running to make
stories.
That, It's true.
And I think in Woodstock there are a lot of interesting stories that come out. There's a lot of movies on different...
Right. And now that you mention it, over half of the films, are female-directed this year, which is remarkable.
And I have to say that I'm sworn to silence because I am on the narrative jury, so I cannot talk about the 9 films that I saw while...
Understood. Right.
I think what we want is not just female-directed films. What we want is just a balance and an equity. We want to see good stories.
Right.
And there's a lot of good stories that aren't being told.
Did you note in your coming from the print background when you did move over to taking over
online
writing? And Yahoo Movies. What was that experience like? Was that very big transition at all for you, or was that
I came from the New York Post.
Right.
And originally. So the contrast between the New York Post, where you're writing very short deadline on things that are going out that are not getting heavily edited, and working for a place like Yahoo Movies is not that different. In fact, I think this whole obsession with listicles that the online places have, if we write about Star Wars, then we'll get a lot of hits on that piece.
Right.
I think is wrong. I think that what you really want to do is consistently have interesting content, and then people will come.
Well, that's a radical take on things. Wait, so you're saying write interesting articles or publish interesting articles, and the people, the readers will come.
Right. I would say that the when I there were two articles that did the, I would say, among the best.
Yeah.
Okay. I covered the Oscars, too, and those naturally, event day, do well. I wrote a piece about the movie The Fault in Our Stars, and I took my daughter, who's a teenager, and I wrote an essay about taking my teenager to that and discovering not only she had read the book, but that she had an insight into this movie that you might not have recognized given the eye-rolling tendency of teens.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a piece about that, and that got over a million hits, hit the front page. Crazy.
Right.
I wrote a piece there's about The Nun. There was a short that was up for an Academy Award about the woman who had been in movies with Elvis and became a nun. And
sounds like the opposite of an Elvis movie.
The opposite,
where
he
gets
he
a crush.
Seduces a nun. No.
He seduces a nun and she gives up her
good habits for a bad
her
one.
Get, right.
But no, great. I wrote, and okay. Sister Rosemary, I think is her name, but she, was at the height of her Elvis-dom and starring with him,
sure.
And was beautiful, and she decided that what really made her tick was being a part of a nunnery and being a part
right.
of an order. And I talked to her, and again, here was someone who had such immense wisdom about people and really explained to me what her relationship with God was in such an interesting way that was a piece that really hit. So I think the world is full of interesting, imaginative stories
right.
that aren't, oh God, 8 things you need to know about Ewoks.
Right. Well, those are essential factoids, after all. By the way, right now you're still writing for Yahoo Movies.
No, I'm no
that's,
longer.
That's over.
Yeah, new
okay.
boss, clean new boss, clean slate.
Okay.
I'm writing occasionally
good.
For Variety, and I am writing for ZealNewYorkCity.com, which is a cultural website in the city, and I review for them.
Okay.
And then I'm doing covers for the New York Observer, and I'm writing a book.
Okay, and the book, which
and
is going to come out next summer, maybe, and then
right.
we can get you back on for a
yeah,
little bit
and
more.
Then I would love to. And then I'm a writer. I like telling stories.
I like your writing a great deal, and I appreciate
thank you.
I appreciate your finding a little time today. Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode number 327 of Film Wax Radio. Coming up on the next episode, Eric Cohen, senior editor for IndieWire, will be back for kind of a year-end look back. And it's his three-peat, meaning it's his third time on the podcast. So thank you, Eric. He'll be again on the next episode with a couple of other really great guests. I will say also, we have a couple of amazing things in the works as far as guests come up for the beginning of the year. I will say this. We are going to get a number of the core members of the creative team behind the Carol, and which is very exciting, leading up to the Oscars to get on some of these other guests. If you haven't seen Carol, that is Todd Haynes' new film starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. Please do yourself a favor and see this film. It is so moving and just spectacular. The acting there will really wrench your heart, and it's just I think Todd Haynes is there up at the top of my favorite filmmakers right now, and there are a few, so that'll be coming up in the new year. I really don't want to give away too much more. I can just say that the show continues to move forward into yet another year, and so I'm very grateful for your support. This year we'll be doing quite a bit to move the show along. And I can say right now that includes a live podcast coming up in March at South by Southwest. I don't know if I've talked about it at all, but it's official. It's a go. If you go on to South by Southwest into their interactive area, you will find it. It's posted there. So far I've got a couple of panelists, guests already, including Tim League of Alamo Draft House, Fantastic Fest, and Draft House Films, and Scott Glasserman, who was on the show recently, who is the CEO of and founder of Gather Films. We're going to be talking about, you know, just experimenting with theatrical for independent filmmakers. So, you know, I go on about that. If you listen to the show, you know that's something like a bone that I don't let go of. Well, at South By, if you're planning on coming, please put that on your calendar. I'll have more information about the specific time and date very soon, in the next week or two. So, and we'll have more panelists also on that live podcast. If you're looking on the South By Southwest site, the name of the event is called Indie Film and the Death of the Theatrical. It's an attention grabber. It's all it is. So I'm excited about that. Thank you very much for listening. Again, we'll be back next week with Eric Cohen and more on this Film Wax Radio. It's a podcast about independent film. So thank you for listening. This is your host, Adam Shartoff, signing off. Until next time, take care.
Tell yourself the biggest lie. Lose yourself. You can't run, but you can't hide. Lose yourself, baby. It's your time. Tell your mama that you are fine. Lose yourself. Fall back on the party line. Lose yourself. Let's go.